Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, this is Military Monday on the RightStream Radio Network, and this is your host, John Gresham. It's a beautiful summer day here in Fairfax, Virginia, tainted only by the fact that we know the days are starting to get shorter. We had the longest 2 days of the weekend over the weekend here, and now it's 3 minutes less a day until the winter solstice. But we're going to enjoy what we've got, and we're going to hopefully give you something to enjoy. Today's show is about a phenomenon that is very quietly being conducted around the world. And this is the process of collectors, call them what you will, scavengers, even archaeologists, going back and collecting implements of war, specifically wrecked combat aircraft. Now, for those of you who have gone to museums, you see the end work of curators, restorers, paint technicians, you name it, in making a recovered aircraft of one kind or another into a museum-quality artifact. Some of these, in fact, are actually flown, and we see these at air shows and exhibitions from time to time. But what are the stories behind this? What does it take to go and find, plan for, finance, recover, and restore a combat aircraft back to its former glory, sometimes decades after it actually crashed or was abandoned? Well, today we're going to go and talk about that with a gentleman who has written extensively about the subject. He is Zenith Press author Nicholas Voronko, and he is the author of two books with Zenith Press, Hidden Warbirds 1 and 2. And Nick, are you there, my friend?
I'm here. Thanks for having me, John.
It's great to have you, and let us say that Nicholas and I share a lot of the same interests, some of the same friends. We even grew up not far from each other. I grew up, of course, in Southern California, as you did as well. And it's, I guess, the first question I have for you is, why did you become interested in this to the point that you actually collect Warbird memorabilia?
Well, I think I have to put the onus on my parents. My dad was very much into aviation. Both my mother and father were private pilots in the 60s, and my brother flies for a major airline now. And my dad went to the first Reno air races in 1964. We went to air shows. For example, we went to the California air races at Mojave. And that just seeing the airplanes and hearing the engines and getting that smell, I think got in both mine and my brother's blood.
So in a real way, you just joined the family business that was aviation.
Sort of, yeah. And California air races at Mojave, you would get in one line for a hot dog, and you'd get to the front, you'd get a bun, and they'd send you in another line to get the hot dog. And it was so disorganized, and I thought, you know, I need to be part of that. So,
and of course, you have gone and become addicted to this a little beyond my simple taste of, shooting photographs or occasionally acquiring a bit or a piece off of an airplane. You actually go and collect whole sections of aircraft, don't you?
Yeah, I've had a pretty interesting hobby. I was an aviation journalist, and when I would go around doing stories, I'd always stop by the local airplane junkyard and look to see what was in there. And I got an aircraft gun turret from a Neptune patrol bomber. And from there, it led to another one and another one. And my friends, I'd say, hey, what are you doing this weekend? And at first it was, oh, yeah, I'll come over and help you. And then when it got to be 9 or 10 turrets, it was like, yeah, I'm busy this weekend. And when I started thinking about buying a forklift, they said, you might consider some therapy. But in that process, I ended up with the tail gunner's compartment to a B-17 that I'm having restored to airworthy condition by Aero Trader down in Chino, California. And I'm hoping that will go back on an airplane someday soon. And I've also sold some of my turrets to aviation museums. For example, I had a real rare Airco left waist turret from a privateer, and that's on the airplane that's on display at the Yankee Air Force Museum in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and a Catalina bow turret that went to a restoration in Australia. So it's kind of one of those things where I got the pieces for my enjoyment, but in a way it's an opportunity for me to give back to aviation.
And your wife still loves you.
Turret in the backyard is a real relationship stretcher. and thankfully, go ahead.
It sounds like you married a very good lady.
Yeah, those things happen. I've used up all my luck after that. But I have a friend of mine that I hang her with, and he has an aviation business, so I'm able to beg, borrow, and steal the infrastructure needed to move the 2,000-pound, 12-foot-long, for example, I have a Neptune nose turret in the forward fuselage section, and that's pretty big. There are very few of them left, so, you know, one day I'd like to see a Neptune flying in tribute to all the patrol bomber pilots and crews from the 50s, and if someone has a Neptune, I've got the turrets to hang on it.
Very good. Now, this fascination you have, not just with viewing the leftovers, but actually recovering and restoring them, where did that part of the interest and fascination come from? What made you want to go through all the trouble? And let's make it very clear, your particular love, which is restoring weapon stations, enforces a sort of a shotgun relationship with a federal agency known as the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which most people don't care to go and deal with. What makes this fascination so good for you, so fulfilling for you?
Well, when I started this in the 1980s, I was in my mid-20s, had no money, but I had my youth, and I was able to go out and start looking for wrecks. I needed parts for my, for example, my B-17 restoration, and even at that time, B-17 parts were pretty pricey. So I started hiking to B-17 crashes to look for parts. And I've probably hiked 120 airplane crashes since then. And it really has become about the people. I've made some good friendships. My relations with other people, you know, people start to know that you're looking for something and they keep their ears out. And it's developing a network. And almost all the restorers, I would say, would probably tell you the same thing. It's all in who you know, and you know if you're willing to share and talk to people. And that's kind of my relationship with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. If you play nice and play by the rules, everyone leaves you alone. So
And of course, they'll let you keep the 50 caliber machine guns and the 20 millimeter cannons.
Yeah, there are certain things you have to do to them in order to make them legal. But, you know, I'm willing to do that. I have gotten some nasty letters from them, you know, when I tell them, hey, I've just recovered this 20 millimeter cannon. They threaten to put me in jail, and then, of course, they see what the cannon looks like bent 90 degrees after it's been in an accident. And then, you know, that's the beginning of establishing a relationship that I'm not out there to do bad.
Fair enough. And I would say your magnificent obsession is relatively minor compared to some who are willing to go and tramp across the globe to some of the most unusual places in the world, not just to go and recover particular systems or subsystems, but try and recover entire wrecks of aircraft, correct?
Yeah, there are guys out there doing it now. Everybody does it. All the major museums, the Air and Space Museum, the Air Force Museum, the National Museum of Naval Aviation, when they need to get outside funding to do this, but when they have found the funding, they've done some incredible work. So it's happening all the time. And one of the things, John, that I wanted to mention is that looking for aircraft crashes is something that anyone can do. Like my dad took me out to see airplanes. You know, if you've got a family that's into hiking, there were more than 7,000 military training crashes in the U.S. from 1942 to 1945. So there, unfortunately, that number represents a lot of people who perished.
7,000? I didn't realize the number was that high.
Yeah, yeah, and that doesn't count, you know, commercial airplanes or anything like that. But, you know, a lot of parks and have wrecks. Here, I live in California, and there was a wreck. It's probably within 2 miles of my house, and it took me 11 years to find it, but I eventually found it. And it's still in an open space area, and although the wreck was removed during the 40s, shortly after the crash, there are still parts there to this day, you know, 70 years later. So it's an interesting way to get the family involved. The combat crashes that are out there, you know, World War II was a global war, and there are airplanes literally everywhere, and they seem to be coming out of the woodwork as of late. There was, I think 2 years ago, a gentleman who was working in the oil business in Egypt was 200 miles from the nearest town, and they stumbled on a crashed Curtiss P-40 fighter that we had lend-leased to the British, and it had been gone missing in June of 42, and in 2012 they stumbled across it, and it was a lot like the just a mystery ship out in the middle of the desert. That airplane has since been recovered.
It told a story about a man, something that happened, and answered the question for his family and friends, what happened to him?
Yeah, it brought closure. And that's what another thing that that looking for aircraft, wreck chasing, aviation, archaeology, what you want to call it, there are a lot of groups out there. There's a group in Southern California called Project Remembrance, where they specialize in taking family members out to crash sites so they can get closure. And that's done by a guy named Pat Maka. So there's a lot of good being done. And speaking of closure and research, my mother's uncle, who was an Olympic-class swimmer in the 30s, had gone to UCLA. And when the war came, he became a bombardier. And if you'd flown five missions by 1944, you were middle of 44, you were pretty much guaranteed to come home. And, of course, on his fifth mission, he was with the 390th Bomb Group and a B-17 called Decatur Deb. They got hit by fighters head-on attacking the synthetic oil plants at Magdeburg, Germany. His airplane went down. Seven were killed. Three were taken prisoner. And my family didn't have any pictures or know much about his war service. And, you know, after the war, nothing was said. And, you know, at family dinners, it was, oh, yeah, you know, Bobby, he was in B-17s. The research that's happening now looking for these airplanes, I was reading a book by a friend of mine, and on page 100, there was a picture of my mom's uncle's crew, and turn the page, and there's a picture of the guy who shot him down.
My so goodness.
70 years later, there's so much research happening into the disposition of all of these airplanes that I think it's really good, and I think, and I'm hoping that my books add to the historical record and, you know, track some of these really interesting stories of what happened to the airplanes and where they're at now.
Just a quick aside for our listeners, both books, which are put out by Zenith Press, are lavishly illustrated, beautifully laid out, and tell the stories of a number of these salvage, recover, and restoration efforts. And I found thumbing through the books really quite compelling this weekend. You've assembled not only good stories, but you've assembled a collection of media that really add to the drama. And there is drama in these stories. Of getting these birds from where they are to where they should be, which is out where the public can see them, touch them, and enjoy them. Who are some of the people who do this on a large scale? Who are some of the people crazy enough and rich enough to go out and actually try and recover an aircraft like a P-38 or a B-17? Who are they and what are they? What kind of folks are they?
A lot of them are, you know, just successful businessmen and women. They could be your neighbors. A number of, on the bigger scale, for example, Paul Allen of Microsoft fame, he's got a wonderful collection up in Seattle. There's a guy named Jim Slattery down in San Diego who's putting together an amazing collection of World War II naval aircraft. He's got a SBD dive bomber, a Dauntless dive bomber, and a Hell Diver under restoration in Northern California, and I profiled those in the book. And they're literally taking these airplanes apart down to the very last rivet and rebuilding, replacing, and these airplanes will be better and safer than new. And they'll have, you know, 50 or 100 years of flight in them when they're done. The interesting thing about having, you know, if you're able to fund a restoration or fund a recovery effort that might cost $500,000 or $600,000, transportation of maybe another $100,000, depending on where it's coming from, and then a restoration of $3 to $4 million. When you talk to these people, even though they have that kind of money, there's still a limit. They still, you know, there's no open checkbook. They still watch every penny and make sure that they're getting the quality that kind of money deserves. The interesting thing is that, for example, there's a guy named Don Brooks who's tried to get a B-17 recovered on more than one occasion. He's since been successful. But, you know, he would give his group that's going to go out and look for the airplane a time limit and a dollar amount limit. And, you know, if they don't find it in that period, then he moves on. So the people who are doing this are, you know, just like everyone else, it's just on a larger scale, I guess. The one thing with
please go ahead.
I'm sorry. The one thing with restoring airplanes, it's like restoring cars or anything else. You don't always get the money that you put in back out of it. There's got to be a love of history, a love of aviation, a love of the technology, and the willingness to share that with the public behind it, because it can't be a profit motive.
And you have to love airplanes. You have to love the feel of them and think about what they can do. I mean, this is a particular kind of crazy.
Yeah. And it, like I said, it can be on any scale. It can be, you know, from a guy doing a day hike with his kids to, you know, spending $10 million to restore a P-38.
And as you say, in many cases, these aircraft are, if the owner cares to do it, flight ready. They can be recertified by the FAA and flown literally as brand new airplanes, correct?
Brand new, or in most cases, better than new. For example, that Helldiver that I mentioned that's being restored in Northern California, the early models had an issue with how the flaps worked, and sometimes they would get one flap on one side would stick up, the other one would come down, and during a carrier approach, when you get that asymmetric lift, it would cause the airplanes to spin out of control, and there wasn't enough altitude for the pilots to recover, and a number of airmen were lost. So when they're doing the restoration, cosmetically it will look the same, but internally they've upgraded those controls so that that won't happen when it's being flown today. So their safety is, there are a lot of things being done for safety and done to accommodate modern avionics that are hidden that you wouldn't see, where the airplane still looks original. So technology has been a good thing for these restorations.
I'm sure that everybody's putting GPS and a few other systems on board to go ahead and improve navigational reliability and other things.
Yeah, and they usually hide them behind old radio faceplates. So you've got that big tube radio box, and then on a hinge, you open it up, and there you've got basically everything you need hidden behind there, so that if someone comes to look inside, they'll see what it was like in the 40s, but once the pilot gets to altitude, he's got everything he needs to get safely from A to B.
Let's talk a little bit about the process, because there is a series of steps that every aircraft recovery involves in one form or another. And the first one is finding the darn things. How do you find airplanes that have crashed or wrecked?
Finding an airplane is 99%, well, maybe 95%, doing your homework. And that involves going through the aircraft individual record cards, crash reports, squadron histories. So once you decide on the type of airplane you want to look for example, if you wanted to look for a Navy Corsair, you've got the aircraft record cards, you've got the squadron histories, you've got the crash reports, you've got the local newspapers, and that's, I was looking for a Navy R4D, which is the civilian version is the DC-3 that had crashed near my house, and the crash report said that it crashed at the 600-foot level, and then gave the town. So we then went to the newspaper and started looking through that, and it said that the airplane crashed on a hillside, and again, there were no streets, and you know, there was no real identifying location, but they said that the first responders were from the Army Dog Training Center in San Carlos. So we were able then to narrow it down to about a four-mile stretch of canyons where this airplane might be. And from there, we started looking at the boundaries of the dog training center and going through the newspaper. And eventually we found some photographs, and we were able to use those photos to line up the hills and found the correct canyon after traipsing through dozens of canyons on our hands and knees looking for parts. Having found the photographs, that really tied it up for us. Where other airplanes are found purely by happenstance, the plane that's on the cover of Hidden Warbirds 1 is a B-17 that's in a swamp in New Guinea. The nearest hard dirt is 4 miles away. And in the 70s, a Royal Australian Air Force crew was flying through the valley in a helicopter and expecting to see nothing but kunai grass for miles. And there was an olive drab B-17 tail right in front of them. And that was how that airplane was found. So it's...
Out of curiosity, has the development of satellite-based commercial imagery like Google Earth, has that provided any useful support to searchers?
That's been tremendous. And it's a real fine art to use that technology, Google Earth, to look for airplanes. Once you've got an area pinned down, you can start using that to look for, you know, anomalies, metal reflections, you know, things that wouldn't be there. The other thing that Google Earth does is it helps plan your route in and out. It can save a lot of time and, of course, increases safety of the people who are looking for it. And then through satellite technology, there are things like Spot, which is a hiker's essentially GPS. Where if you don't come back by a certain time, you know, they can ping that and find where you are. So the technology has been really good for aircraft recovery people.
And you're already bringing up a point that I think is well worth making, and that is this is not a casual activity. This has dirty, dangerous aspects to it.
Dirty, dangerous, and it's a big business. For example, the guys looking at that B-17 in the New Guinea swamp were dealing with malarial mosquitoes, crocodiles. The temperature on the airplane that they were working on was 110, 114 degrees. Again, if you dropped a tool there, it was gone. It just went to the bottom. So not only there in the deserts, you know, you've got heat exhaustion. You're having to bring all of your own supplies, essentially, on all of these. So it's a logistics test as well.
And as you say, this costs a lot of money. I mean, when you go on safari to go ahead and work one of these, it's got to cost thousands of dollars a day, minimum.
Yeah, because you've got, first you have to get there, and you know, the remote farther out it is, the more it's going to cost to get there. You've got to get your gear there. Oftentimes you're going to have to bring your own food and water. Sometimes you're going to have to bring your own transportation, whether it be a boat or a snowmobile or what. When they went and recovered a P-38 from under 260 feet of ice in Greenland, they had to bring everything. They even had to buy aircraft in order to support themselves up on the ice cap, because the military doesn't hire itself out for these types of expeditions. They may support you as part of a training exercise, but they're not going to be there, you know, day in and day out, getting what you need and bringing supplies. The other thing is fuel. You know, it costs money to buy fuel, and it costs money to transport it. So the farther out you are, the more expensive. Sometimes you may have to bring in heavy equipment, so you're going to need an aircraft that's capable of, you know, bringing in a small dozer or a backhoe. So it's very costly. And it's, on top of that, there have been people who've lost their lives doing it. So it can be costly not only in terms of money, but in terms of people.
We're going to go and take a quick – go ahead.
No, go ahead.
We're going to take a quick network break to post some messages, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about this process of not only finding these aircraft, but how you set up and plan one of these salvages. And with that, we will be back in a couple of minutes. This is the RightStream Radio Network.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvis. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
Honor Flight provides, at no cost to the veteran, the opportunity to see the memorial that the American people have built on our National Mall. And I think that there's probably no better organization out there today that can provide something to somebody for nothing.
If anyone wants to see the importance of Honor Flight, look into the veterans' eyes and how they tear up when they are brought here.
When they walk into that memorial and they see that their friends will never be forgotten, that the sacrifice that they paid will always be cherished, always revered, always honored by this nation, they're taken back by that.
The best program I've ever been associated with. You know, we're all in the same fraternity. If it hadn't been for these guys, I don't know where we'd be today or what language we'd speak.
I say about the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, if it weren't for these guys, we wouldn't have to worry about terrorists today. We'd already be occupied. We'd already be a different country. So we owe them
a lot. We're racing against a clock. In another 5 to 7 years, it'll be a moot point. They will be gone. We're working as fast as we can, but we need so much support from so many people to make these dreams a reality. This is probably the last chapter in their lives, and for some, it's literally the last paragraph of their lives. What a way to end their stories.
This has been one of the really great days of my life.
I'm sure glad I was able to live long enough to see it.
In a moment, cancer changed our lives forever.
We were told nothing could be done to enjoy these final moments together.
But in that moment, when all seemed lost,
St. Jude Children's Research Hospital gave us hope.
Because at this moment, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital is saving lives with pioneering research and care. We're changing the way the world treats childhood cancer by sharing our discoveries with doctors and scientists everywhere.
And we'll never have to pay St. Jude for anything, ever.
At this moment, she wants to be in her own bed.
I want to be back at school with my friends.
I want to be outside playing.
Please take a moment and join St. Jude in finding cures and saving children. Visit stjude.org.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we are back. It is on Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. Our guest today is Nicholas Vlaranco. Nick, are you still with us there, sir?
I'm here, John.
Excellent. I wanted to finish up one more question that, and then move on to the question about planning. How much work is there that goes into the survey of a wreck before you make the decision, yeah, let's go salvage this thing? I mean, are we talking potentially a couple of years or more of work just figuring out if it's possible?
Yeah, a couple of years at best. You need to do a site visit, and the site visit is to check the condition of the airplane, find out what the logistics are going to be to get your crew there and back, and then what it's going to take to get the airplane out of the location it's in. And a lot of the time is spent organizing the permits and getting legal title to the airplane. Sometimes you have to get maritime salvage attorneys involved to make sure that you're not going to go spend $500,000-$600,000 to recover an airplane only to have it end up in someone else's collection once you get it back if they claim title to it. So there's so much that's required in doing your homework before an airplane can be recovered. It's quite an involved process.
I assume that includes, particularly with governments like the United States, Great Britain, and such, if this is, for example, a war grave or an airplane of interest to them, they can obviously make such recoveries a bit more complicated, can't they?
Yeah, and most recovery efforts are done for airplanes where they weren't a war grave. I know that there are certain treaties involved. The U.S. Air Force basically says anything before 1961, they don't claim title to it. They've got a nice collection. They've got certainly almost one of everything, although I think they may change their stance, whereas the U.S. Navy has laid claim to everything that they have ever owned, aircraft or ship, and they want to manage their recoveries. Unfortunately, in another 50 years, there may not be anything to recover with a lot of these airplanes going down in salt water. So it is a process.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about what's involved. A good example, you talked about the B-17 that crashed into the savanna grass area in New Guinea, and essentially what you're on top of is a large pool of very deep mud with grass that's razor sharp and able to go ahead and cut you. In the middle of an area of the world which is not entirely friendly to the United States and other English-speaking countries. The question, of course, is how do you plan for that? What kind of things do you have to go and put together to plan a salvage of that sort?
That airplane, it was discovered in about 73, and there were a couple attempts in the 1980s to get it out, and then it took from basically 1990 to probably 2007 of people going down and negotiating with the New Guinea government, trying to – you had tribal leaders in the area that all claimed – ownership of the airplane. Some believe that there were spirits living in the airplane. There no men died in that crash. So a lot of negotiation, and then once the deal was made, you know, they had to arrange for bringing in all the supplies, bringing them up the coast, inland on a river. And as they were going across or going up the river, they were passing different tribal areas, so they had to appease each tribe as they got to their base camp, and then 4 miles out to the airplane and back. And in this case, they used a lot of lifting bags, and once the parts were off, they came in with a helicopter, picked the parts up, and took them to a barge off the coast. Then it was barged down to Ley, New Guinea, and then a legal battle ensued with another American who wanted to use that airplane as a tour destination, whereas the guys who recovered it, that was one of the first airplanes to take the fight to the Japanese after Pearl Harbor, and they felt it would be better viewed and certainly viewed by more people at a museum in the United States. And they eventually won that legal battle. The airplane was brought to California and is now at the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum in the process of being restored. So logistically...
And you bring up a good point that there are individuals who have nothing to do with the salvage who frequently inject themselves into the process of determining ownership, often for less than, shall we say, ethical or legal reasons.
Yes, that's happened. I don't have enough fingers and toes to count the number of times that's happened. And the problem is that just adds more to the cost of the restoration. You know, certainly $250,000 to fight something like that in international court. And for the New Guinea government, because it changes so often, you know, it's probably changed 6 or 8 times since they started the process of trying to get that B-17. Whereas 15 years before, the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum, which is in Reading, Pennsylvania, they were able to get an extremely rare Northrop P-61 Black Widow night fighter off of a mountain near Hollandia, New Guinea. And they presented the New Guinea government with a trade. They were going to bring an airplane to New Guinea for their national museum in exchange for the rights to remove this P-61. And it went smoothly. The airplane's it's probably 75% restored in Pennsylvania now, and they're doing a crowdfunding to get money to finish the rest of it. And there are maybe 5 P-61s in the world, and this one will be a flyer. So
really,
yeah, you're
that's going to be outstanding.
And through this recovery, you're bringing back extinct airplane types, and the P-61 made a major contribution to the war on the.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. And this is a point that I wanted to make to our listeners. In many cases, these people who do these wreck salvages and restorations are bringing back aircraft types which are one of a kind in many cases. They are finding the single remaining one that's been discovered in all the world. And that's a genuine... act of philanthropy to go ahead and find one of those, bring it back, restore it, and put it on display for people to see.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And over the years, through this process, we've gone from having like one flying P-38 to now maybe 8 or 9, and in the coming years, you know, that may actually double with the amount of airplanes that have been recovered and are under restoration now. So,
God, would it be amazing to see flights of 4 type airplanes, be it Mustangs, Thunderbolts, or Lightnings, all at one time. That would be a mind-boggling thing for me as an aviation historian.
Well, this year at the Planes of Fame Air Museum's air show in Chino, they had 4 Thunderbolts, and last year they had 5 flying P-38s with 2 more on the ground on static display, so 6 in one place at once. And you're right, for an aviation enthusiast or historian, that was mind-blowing.
Yeah, we're talking for those who don't understand, those of us who love airplanes. We are talking a form of nirvana, and it's this is one of the reasons the people who love us and care for us are so special, because, as we said earlier, it's a particular kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Nick, the recovery effort itself, I'd like to talk about a couple of the more extreme ones, and one that just comes to mind constantly is this recovery of a P-38 frozen in the ice almost 300 feet below ground level, or what passes for ground in Greenland. Talk about that particular recovery and the people who worked on it and the problems and dangers they faced as they did it.
That was started by a guy named Pat Epps. There were some other people who had looked for it before, but Pat Epps, he owns an aviation fixed base operation in Atlanta, and he had wanted to go look for these airplanes. And not only did they have to get there, find the airplane, and recover it, but they had to literally invent the technology to find these airplanes under the ice. That was part of Operation Bolero, where B-17 would lead a group of fighters over as we were trying to build our air arm over in England. And these airplanes got weathered in and ended up setting down as a group on the ice, and hence the name the Lost Squadron. And everyone thought, you know, 40 years after the war that, oh, you know, they'd just be there. We'd jack them up, put gas in the tanks and fly the airplanes out. And when they got to the spot where the airplanes were, not only were they not there, but with the movement of the glacier, they had moved about 12 miles. So they had to find the airplanes, get all the gear up there to build a camp, go out, drag ground-penetrating radar. They brought in specialists from Norway or Sweden, somewhere over there, that had done a lot of work on glaciers to help figure out, you know, what is under there and what anomalies are they looking at. Once they found planes, they were able to drill down and take a hole saw, essentially, at the end of a 300-foot drill bit and bring up a piece. And with that, they were then awarded an extended permit from the Danish government to recover the airplanes. They drilled down to a B-17 called Big Stoop. And because of its diameter, the weight of the ice had crushed the fuselage to about 4 feet tall.
Aww.
And they stripped some parts off of that, and they were pretty heartbroken. And then they realized that the P-38 was built to withstand more G-forces, so the structure is going to be a lot more robust, and they figured that that airplane would be fairly intact. So they had to made a couple trips up and tried to figure out ways to get down to the airplanes. They had one group came up and essentially brought a silo unloader. It made this giant, 25-foot diameter hole as it went down, but it only got down about 40 feet and it crapped out. And Don Brooks, who was instrumental in another couple recoveries, he and a woman from Georgia invented the Gopher, which was basically a plumb bob weight with heating coils on the outside, and it would heat water and melt its way down about a 4-foot diameter hole. And they got down to the P-38. They had to, using hot water, blow a cavern around it. And it took, about an hour, hour and a half to be lowered down on a bosun's chair. I don't know if you've ever ridden on a bosun's chair, but it doesn't look the safest thing. Riding one up a 30-foot mast or a 40-foot mast is one thing, but 260 feet sitting on that. The other, as you're going down, you're just looking at ice for an hour. The other thing is, if the glacier had shifted while those guys were down there, they would have either been crushed, or had they survived the movement of the ice, it would have taken days to get back down to them. So they were putting their lives on the line to go get this airplane. Then once they got down there, they had to get it apart, and you can't cut it apart because you've got to be able to put it back together. So they brought a bunch of specialized tools. They took the airplane apart, and then they got it back to Kentucky where it was rebuilt. And the airplane wasn't crushed, but it was – every piece was out of true. So they had to literally reform all of these pieces, either make new or bend the original pieces back, heat treat them, and they were inventing, metal forming technologies to get this airplane right. It now flies as Glacier Girl, and it's a beautiful restoration. And it's owned by Lewis Air Legends, Rod Lewis, out of the San Antonio, Texas area. And it makes probably 8 to 12 appearances a year around the country, so people can see what a P-38 looked like and what a P-38 from under 260 feet of ice looked like. And I bet it cost, $6 or $7 million to find that airplane and get it restored, maybe more.
Though I would say, given my personal predilection and yours, we would say it was well worth the effort.
By far. It's tremendous. And the interesting thing is, once you have an airplane like that, you can't just let anybody fly it. And there aren't that many people who have P-38 time around. For certainly a long while, the only guy the insurance companies would let fly it was Steve Hinton, who's the president of the Planes of Fame Museum out in California. So you got to have talent.
And, the dark side of that is that you and I know, have a mutual friend who died flying a P-38 up in Cheddar, Oregon, Jeff Ethel. And it's not that Jeff wasn't a great pilot or competent. He just got confused by the fuel system on the P-38.
Yeah. And with two engines, if you lose one, you're going to have – the manual says if you lose an engine, you just pull back the power and put it on the ground. But if the terrain ahead of you isn't going to accommodate a forced landing, then – you have to get out of it, and nobody wants to jump out of a rare airplane like that.
Now, there is a certain amount of responsibility which goes with the ownership of such an aircraft, and you have a legacy that you're trying to protect and a responsibility to take care of. Let's talk about another one. What is another extreme salvage and recovery that you recall from your books?
Well, I had mentioned Don Brooks, who was up on the P-38 and the B-17 recovery at Greenland. His dad was a tail gunner on the B-17 Liberty Bell with the 390th Bomb Group. And Don wanted to have an airplane in tribute to his dad. And he had found, he had gone to look for the Big Stoop. That didn't work out. So he had found another airplane that had set down on Christmas Eve of 1947 in a place near Labrador called Dyke Lake. And the airplane landed on the ice. The guys were rescued the following afternoon. They were even carrying, it was basically a supply run that the B-17 was making. They were bringing back two servicemen who had died through non-combat accidents. The airplane set down on the lake, and everyone figured, well, you know, we'll just go up there, we'll dive down, the airplane will be sitting on the bottom, and we'll suck it up, and off we'll go. So he sent Bob Mester and Mark Allen, two marine salvage experts, essentially, from Washington State, to go look for the airplane. And, again, you're out in the middle of nowhere. There's maybe some fish camps near there. So they had to bring everything they needed. They had to take it up to up to Labrador and then out to the site. So food, shelter, they had to bring their own rowboats. They had to bring their own dive gear. There was no room for a compressor, so the tanks that they brought were the scuba tanks that they were going to have to make useful. They went out to the site, they dove down, and the airplane wasn't there. And they had been given, X amount of dollars and X amount of days to find the airplane, so they started increasing their search pattern. And as the days went by, they were getting more frustrated. They were just about to leave when someone had said, oh, you know what? They had talked to one of the locals, and again, who do you know? One of the locals said, in one of the fish camps, there's an airplane seat that's right around the campfire. And they went and looked at the airplane seat, and sure enough, it was a B-17 navigator's chair. So they knew that the airplane was somewhere around there, but this fish camp was 12 miles away. And they did find the B-17 underwater near the fish camp, but the B-17 had to travel down the lake, had to shoot the rapids, and then end up in this place. What they had figured was that the B-17 landed on the frozen lake. The next year, over the years, the ice around the airplane had melted, but the airplane sheltered the ice below it so that it was essentially sitting on an ice raft. The current took the airplane downstream. It shot at some point, the ice raft underneath melted, and that was where the B-17 ended up. So the divers then had to come back. They had to come back with a crew of divers and all new supplies, take the airplane apart underwater, and because all of the steel bolts had corroded away, they had to rebuild a lot of the airplane, like reattach the outer wing panels. The engine mounts had gone away. So they had to reattach all of these pieces so that they could then lift the airplane up on airbags and then float it to the nearest place where they could get a crane to lift it out of the water. Well, that place, the nearest spot of hard ground near the river, near a road, was 80 miles away by boat.
Oh, my God.
So while this was happening, they had gotten the province in Canada to give them permission and ownership to the airplane. They used the B-17 that's in Seattle, called Boeing B at the Museum of Flight. They had used that to figure out how to attach the lift bags and how much lift they'd need. And they essentially brought it, the airplane up, and it was the center section of the fuselage and the wings. And they made a raft and floated this thing 80 miles to the nearest ground. And I think it took something like 80 hours of pulling this raft and having it sink partway and having to refloat it. And that was dangerous as all hell. But they finally got it to a road. They disassembled it and trucked it to Georgia, where the airplane's under restoration today.
Outstanding. And that takes us to the final step in the process, which is that restoration you were talking about. Now, hypothetically, you salvage, a mid-sized airplane like a B-17, you're obviously not going to take it home in one piece. You're going to disassemble it, put it on flatbed trucks or something, and you're going to carry all the pieces home. Hypothetically speaking, how many truckloads is that?
6 or 8 at least. A guy named Mike Kellner had found a B-17 that was cut apart up in Maine. And he trucked it home with his pickup truck and a really long trailer. I think it took him 6 or 8 loads.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And you get home with it. Go ahead, please.
I would just say, yeah, you get home with it, and then, you know, then the difficult part starts. And that is, you know, inventorying what you have, seeing what's usable, and then starting the restoration. Nowadays, we're fortunate with, you know, CNC technology. You can upload the blueprints to a part, put it in the CNC machine, and nowadays people, they don't just make one, they make 6, so that other B-17 operators or other operators of that type of airplane you're rebuilding, if they need a part, you've got a part. You don't want to sell that part that you've made, but you want to have it available to trade for something you might need. So once you have your restoration going, parts become the currency of getting things done.
And you have an airplane on the front of Hidden Warbirds 2 that's being pulled out of, I believe, the ocean, and I can't even tell what kind of airplane that was, and yet because you're telling this story, I know that airplane's going into restoration. What was it, and what was actually left there after years in salt water?
So that is the only Dornier DO-17 flying pencil, and that was one of the bombers that attacked Britain during the Battle of Britain. And it's inverted, as you see it there. So the cockpit is facing downward, and that airplane, because it was in salt water and it is, you know, fairly far gone, they will restore it to an what they call as found diorama, where they'll put it next to maybe a British Hawker Hurricane that was also recovered from the ocean, so that people can see, you know, what the state of preservation is, and they can also see this airplane type was extinct until this was brought up, you know, 2 years ago.
It was an impressive find, and to actually get what was left up and out of the English Channel was an amazing piece of underwater archaeology, obviously.
And if you look at the photo on the cover there, all the different lifting devices, strong backs they had to use to get it out of the airplane, get the airplane out of the water, it's pretty amazing. And they had done some other engineering where they were going to build basically an underwater crate around the airplane and bring it up. and it ended up that their window of opportunity to pick it up before the weather went bad forced them to change to this method. But again, there
now,
were years.
Obviously,
of,
every wreck is different. Every salvage effort is different. So what you get out of it is different. And yet there are some basic things that restoration requires you to do. What are some of the things in your personal experience in working with your weapons mounts that you've had to do to go and get those pieces of equipment back into usable shape and ready for display?
Well, for example, with my B-17 tail, at some point the airplane that I had gotten it off of had had a tail gear collapse, and then the repair to that wasn't, I mean, it was airworthy, but it wasn't to new original standards. And then the airplane it was on went to South America, and they had done some other modifications. So it required getting the original plans, building new stringers, and reassembling the piece to manufacture standards. And then I had to find some of the original pieces to go into it that were very, I was going to have them made. And one night I was at work and I thought, oh, I'm going to take a mental break, and looked on eBay, and somebody had found a wreck and had drilled off all the parts I needed, coincidentally, and put them on eBay with a buy it now price. So that was how I found a lot of the really rare stuff I needed. And going out to wrecks was another way to find stuff. So it...
And is there not all variety of problems just finding the right paints and colors to go ahead and make a credible restoration? I mean, painting has got to be a big deal with these things.
Yeah, that's a science in itself. Most of the military left very detailed painting instructions, so a lot of that can be found. It's just a matter of, is the person funding the restoration willing to go that extra mile for authenticity? And I'm happy to say that in the last, like, 10 or 12 years, all the restorations are going that direction. They're going back to as authentic as it can be, down to even the coating of the wires that they're using. State-of-the-art coatings, but it looks exactly as it did during the war.
Very nice. As we come to the end of this show, what is the state of wreck salvage and restoration? It almost sounds like we're in the middle of a kind of renaissance for this right now. What is your feeling about both the movement to go and salvage and restore, as well as the people in it these days?
I agree with you. We are in a renaissance. There are so many projects coming to light, and the new economy is giving people the resources to fund these restorations. I think you're going to see, more Thunderbolts, more P-38s, a lot more one-of-a-kind airplanes. For example, the only Brewster-built Corsair is under restoration, and that may be flying in 2 or 3 years. So a lot of people with resources and a lot of historians are pushing those people towards historians and researchers or restoration experts are pushing them towards authenticity. So it's there are going to be some incredible airplanes flying in the next 5 to 10 years.
And with that, let's talk a little about you and your work. You've obviously put out these two books for Zenith Press. Is there volume 3 out there, or where are you headed with your next projects in terms of your writing?
Well, I got to say, Zenith Press, the people there are really good. They give me the opportunity to set up the story and then let the people who actually did the recoveries tell their story in these books. And Hidden Warbirds 2 just came out about 2 weeks ago. So hopefully this will do well, and maybe there will be a third one in the works.
What other kinds of things are you wanting to work on in the next couple of years?
Well, my parents dragged me to see a lot of the Diego Rivera murals in Mexico when I was a kid, and I just came out with a book on Depression-era murals in the Bay Area, and so I have both an art interest and an aviation interest. My other interest, I'm working on a book called Hidden War Ships to kind of follow on the Hidden Warbirds aspect, and that'll be out next year. I was just talking to a gentleman who led the recovery of the Bronze Eagle off the stern of the Graf's Bay down in Uruguay. So kind of touching on all corners of the world, and the airplane guys cross over a lot to ships, so a lot of the cast of characters from Hidden Warbirds 1 and 2 will be in Hidden War Ships.
Well, when you get that ready to put out, please give me a call. We'd love to have you back on the show.
John, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Listen, it has been a genuine pleasure. Thank you for coming, and you have a great, great week ahead, and I hope we get to go and hear from you again very soon.
Great, thanks. Best to you and your listeners.
Thank you. And with that, we come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. However, this week I'm going to be doing two shows here on the Right Stream Radio Network. Tomorrow afternoon, I will be subbing for Daria Ann to do a show about publicizing small to mid-size market books. Our guest will be the head of promotions for Mr. Veronco's publisher, Zenith Press. So please join us tomorrow, and you can learn a little bit about how small to mid-sized publishers do credible work in the realm of book publicity. This is John Gresham, and we hope we'll hear from you again soon. Next week on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? Took a flat to a pawn shop. Got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? I saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw cherished freedom. Freedom never cries. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man. The song to a dead man, to me.
cherished freedom. Freedom never cries. You can cry for her, die for her, lay down your life for her, kiss and wave goodbye to her. Anything at all, you can cry for her, die for her. There's a baby on the doorstep, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flare to a pawn shop, pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.